the internet and the various methodology, where it's social media, email, whatever, is just a conduit for what's already existing. So, you know, the existence of extreme right wing and extreme left wing movements.
In this episode, I interview the founder and chief executive of Diffuse Global, Philip Grindel, dubbed the online bodyguard by the UK media. You may have seen recently commenting on the sad death of Caroline Flack, the reality TV star. Philip's company, Diffuse Global, protect and advise some of the UK's most recognisable public figures and politicians. Prior to his role at Diffuse, Philip was a UK police detective and was specifically invited to help set up a unit after the murder of the MP, UK MP Joe Cox, in order to prevent such tragedies happening again. Part of their approach is to analyse the threats made to public figures on social media and email, etc., just to see whether they are likely to result in a physical threat taking place. This was an incredible episode, if I do say so myself. It was really wide-ranging, and we discuss such areas like tall poppy syndrome that we have in the UK, misogyny, anonymity, cultural norms, how to deal with trolls, specific advice there, and also the principles of working from home during this COVID-19 lockdown. So I really hope that you will enjoy and take some fantastic advice from this episode with Philip Grindel, and please do send your comments and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and follow on Spotify, and let me know what you think.
Yes. So, hi, Philip. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Very good to speak to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's been a while, but there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. Thank you for agreeing to be part of the Digital Culture Change podcast, and I think it's a really apt time for us to be speaking with the COVID-19 crisis, pandemic all over the world, and the advent of how much people are using technology much more through necessity. Before we start, it'd be great to kind of find out about your background and what you currently do.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I guess of most kind of interest, I suppose, I spent 30 years in the Met Police. But the last few years are particular of relevance, I suppose, where following the murder of Joe Cox, I was the person that was called in to Parliament by the Metropolitan Police and tasked with effectively stopping that happening again. And within that, investigating or setting up a team and investigating and managing the volume and the hostility that was being communicated towards politicians, predominantly online, but not exclusively through social media, as some might think, and kind of getting involved in that world of looking at the threats and the abuse and what have you that they received. And I have to be honest, I did that for about 3 years until I retired from the police. And in that time, was shocked, and that, you know, it takes some doing to shock me, but I was shocked at the level of hatred, the level of violence, the level of and the volume of abuse that was targeted towards politicians. I was shocked by the realization that women are far more like or are targeted in a very different way to men, but are far more likely to be targeted with communicated violence and what have you. And as a result of that, I was doing a master's degree in security management, and I which was pretty much a kind of terrorism-based study. But in terms of my dissertation, I then looked at the attacks on British politicians this century, so since the turn of the century, and looked at the various theories of threat against public figures and how they mapped against those attacks. And there are numerous theories which, you know, as you often is the case, are very well researched and understood and known in the US, less so in this country. And predominantly they're seen from in terms of a psychological perspective. So most of the people that study them are sort of forensic and clinical psychologists and psychiatrists rather than security professionals. But I was very fortunate in that I was invited to Harvard University to engage in a small conference with some handpicked experts around violence towards female politicians across the globe. And some of the experts that I was studying and had written and was reading their academic research were actually at that gathering, and I became quite good friends with them, and was able to really pick up their brains and pick on you know some of their sort of expertise and knowledge and challenge it and question it, and get a really good feel for some of those theories. As I was doing that within the policing structure, we were consistently being approached by non-political organizations in terms of other organizations, other people saying, can you help us? And the answer was always no. And it was no because I was being funded by Parliament to look after Parliament. But it clearly identified to me something of a gap in the market in terms of, well, who actually is helping these people? But it, you know, and the answer is, well, some people are doing it, but they don't really necessarily understand what they're dealing with in terms of the theories of how a threat looks towards a normal person, if you like, a politician, a celebrity, a business person, because they actually are communicated differently. And unless you understand the science behind it and you understand what makes one thing a higher risk than another person, you will miss things. And so that's why I launched Diffuse. And we actually formally launched probably November last year, so 2019. And you know, I've been fortunate in that we've been hugely successful very quickly, with a great deal of media coverage and insight. And so that's what I do now. We work with public figures and influencers who are being targeted on or offline. And by that, that includes chief executives and directors of big businesses who are being targeted, anyone effectively who has a public profile. And it's been, as I say, it's been successful, which is in a way a kind of bad thing because it demonstrates the need for it and how many people are, in fact, feeling unsafe. And so that's what we now do with Diffuse.
I mean, it's laudable what you're doing. It's an amazing timing. And because it feels like the narrative in the media is nobody knows what to do. It's a bit like a hot potato, you know. And I was shocked a few years ago when I started looking at different, you know, people on YouTube, and I'd come across, I like watching people who do cover versions. Sure. Using their particular instrument of songs, and yeah. There's some really good women out there, girls even, and sometimes when you look at the comments you think, wow, what is wrong with you? I mean,
yeah,
what must be going in somebody's head to actually take the time to actually write a negative, non-constructive, destructive comment from somebody who's putting themselves out there to do their best and living their dream. It's kind of scary, really. What does it say about people or the world that we're living in that has been, I don't say technology causes it, that's my personal opinion. I feel like it's just revealing what people are really like.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely on the money there, Larry. None of this behavior exist because of the internet. The internet and the various methodology, where it's social media, email, whatever, is just a conduit for what's already existing. So, you know, the existence of extreme right wing and extreme left wing movements, they're there anyway. It's just they're using this as a method of communication. you know, I think there's long, for a long, long time, there's been a phrase called tall poppy syndrome, where, and some countries are more virulent at it than others, and certainly I think the UK are one of them, where, you know, you almost kind of like don't like people to get too big for themselves, so we like to chop them down whenever we feel that they're getting some success or they're getting a bit above themselves. My perception is that's slightly different in the US, where they kind of celebrate success a bit more than we do. But yeah, I think, so that to me, some of that is a bit of that. I think, you know, and my personal view is there's a huge exposure of the misogynistic environment we all exist in, because a great deal of the abuse that women and girls and females get generally is from men. And, you know, I think there's lots of really deep issues around that, around culturally how we as human beings have evolved. I mean, I think, you know, if we go back to its most basic level, you know, if you look at every single god, if you like, that exists in terms of whatever religion you are, whether it's Christian, whether it's Muslim, whether it's whatever, you know, predominantly they're always male figures that we worship rather than female figures. So you kind of think the whole kind of misogynistic angle must have, you know, it seems to be steeped into our psyche somewhere. And I think that a lot of the abuse that I have seen and personally witnessed, exposed to and dealt with has been misogynistic, and has been sometimes about, and this is just my perception, sometimes about the fact that we now have more successful females. And that means that some of these unsuccessful men feel threatened by that.
Yeah.
And so the only way they can really combat that or somehow make themselves feel better or make themselves feel worthy is by in some way trying to drag these successful female down, be they politicians, musicians, whatever. Celebrity, you know, whatever, chief executives, whatever it might be. It seems to me that certainly when we were investigating the abuse against female politicians, it was nearly always, although not exclusively, but nearly always, a male that was doing it. And it often fitted certain demographics. And, you know, it would often be a white middle-aged man who would often be living in an environment that was fairly... or could be perceived as being uninspiring, and they might have felt they weren't necessarily as successful as they wanted to be.
So it's almost like a typical bully situation where, they are insecure about themselves. So to make themselves feel better about themselves, they want to put somebody else down.
And I think, you know, I've always sort of said that everything I dealt with it, you know, at its basic level is bullying.
I know
we now call things cyberbullying as opposed to just bullying, but fundamentally it's bullying. And there's a real difference, and this is where in many ways you know, diffuse and come into their own, is around, so how do you, you know, when you are a victim of all that, how do you differentiate those that are likely to attack or likely to be physically threatening to you or dangerous to you from those that are just being hostile and sending nasty, threatening, horrible, abusive messages? Because that's what people want to know. They want to, you know, people feel threatened. And a really good example is, I was dealing with a client yesterday who was talking about they're being cyber stalked and what have you. And, you know, they were talking about their fears are, well, I feel like, you know, I'm going to be a victim of an acid attack or something. So what happens is quite often is that when you are the victim of a consistent campaign of hatred, you start becoming what's called hypervigilant, and that means you start seeing threats that aren't necessarily there. You start
second guessing yourself, sort of.
Yeah, but also seeing things that aren't really there. You know, even if you go outside for a walk, somebody looks at you in a way that you interpret to be threatening when it might not be threatening.
Yeah.
Because your brain is wired for survival, and therefore your brain is searching for those threats. And what's happening is it's seeing them and it's misinterpreting what they are, but it's doing it to keep you alive.
Yeah.
So, but actually what you need to know is if someone actually said to you, look, I've analysed these threats this person's making to you, they don't pose you any physical risk. That gives them already a degree of comfort. Mm. It doesn't necessarily mitigate some of the psychological and reputational harm that they suffer, but it does allow them to say, okay, if I trust you and if I believe you, then I'm not going to be physically attacked. And therefore, that gives you a degree of peace of mind.
Yeah, it's it must be really hard. You know, somebody who might be famous wants to go to a shop in Clapham Junction, and they're kind of second guessing themselves. Well, you know, I'm famous. I just want to go about my business. I want to live a normal life, but people spot me. Are they going to be a threat to me? Do they want a selfie? You know, there's so many things that must go through their minds. Never mind being able to go home and do their profession. You know,
I think some of that's choice, isn't it? Because I mean, we're all familiar with various, you know, incredibly successful people who do that. They do go shopping in Clapham Junction, and they do go for a drink, and no one bothers them because they're used to seeing them, or they might do your selfie, etc., etc. And then there's others that seek out the press and live by the oxygen of publicity, because that's the way their world is. And because of that, they then can't do the day-to-day things that they might want to do. So to some degree, there's a kind of choice in that. Mm. You know, in others, less so. But certainly, anybody, you know, you don't have to be a celebrity, or you don't have to be in the public eye to fall victim. These are human behaviours. They are not akin to just being a celebrity. So anybody who is being cyberbullied will also have the same responses to that as what we've just discussed in terms of hypervigilance, etc.
I wonder if there's a thing where a campaign or something where people need to just think before they press send, because, you know, sometimes, you know, say for instance during the Brexit negotiations and everything, sometimes you want to respond to somebody and you think to yourself, is it really worth it? Just sit on it, and often it's not worth it. You know, there was the unfortunate situation with a boxer the other day who sent out a video about domestic violence, and you think to yourself, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I mean, in what world is that okay?
Yeah.
And not even funny. I mean, it's not even... Do you think people... How do you think people need to change their behaviours to think before they actually press send?
Well, I think there's quite a bit of research actually about how people feel more at liberty to express things and say things and do things online than they would ever do in real life, including the boxer or what have you. Yeah. So there is a kind of psychological aspect to this. You know, I would probably make an argument there's a degree of intelligence required about, you know, what you put online and how you respond to it. So, you know, I'm afraid in terms of the case around the boxer, well, that's his pure stupidity and ignorance. And so, you know, you kind of question, if that's what you're prepared to do online, what do you do offline?
That's not his first rodeo either, you know, unfortunately.
No, I bet it's not. Of course it won't be. So, you know, the people that are saying, you know, when Brexit was going on, you know, I worked through Parliament in that period. It was probably the busiest time it's ever been. I know it's not that busy anymore. So we really saw it, and many of the people that were sending stuff were doing so from an emotional perspective rather than from an intellectual perspective.
Yeah.
So what's happening is people respond emotionally to something rather than intellectually. Now we all heard things on the news we didn't agree with. Many of us didn't agree with things passionately, or we had passionate views. The difference is whether your emotional intelligence kicks in and whether you respond to that, or whether you actually abstract the kind of intellectual perspective and say, yeah, but hang on a minute, let's just think about this, and actually, you know, I'm not going to respond to that, or I'm not going to say this, or I'm not going to do that. So, you know, I think it's about an emotional response, you know, as opposed to an intellectual response. And that's, you know, but fundamentally, people feel far freer to express themselves in a way that they would never say many of the things that go on the internet, on social media. They'd never say to your face. Because there's immediate consequences of doing that.
Yeah.
Whereas when you say things on the internet, there are no real consequences.
And especially if people set up, you know, accounts that aren't themselves, you know, this a fake account of some description, which is
incognito. But even in their real identity, they feel very liberal to say and do what they want.
Mm.
I mean, the whole kind of conversation around anonymity is a bit of a misnomer for me, because I believe in anonymity on the internet. And the reason I believe in anonymity on the internet is because, you know, we're looking at it from our perspective and here in a relatively free democratic environment.
Mm.
But if you look around the world where people are oppressed and are being, you know, suppressed by the state, they have to be anonymous in order to highlight social injustice and all sorts of other issues that are going on there. And if they weren't able to do it anonymously, they'd probably be killed.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of risk of it. And in the UK even, I mean, even that we are in a liberal democratic society, you know, there are people that, even in the coronavirus period, have been looking to raise issues around for the NHS not having the equipment they need, but feeling that they need to do it anonymously because they fear for their careers.
Yeah.
So I believe in anonymity. I don't think anonymity is the big bad wolf that everyone says it might be, because the truth is, an awful lot of people say stuff in their own identity. And also, if you really want to find out who most of these people are, you can. And again, that's what we do.
Now,
yes, you know, there are ways to hide your identity. There are ways to hide certain things. But I think, you know, we shouldn't be sort of throwing, you know, the bathwater out and saying, oh, we shouldn't allow anonymity. Or say things like, well, everyone should have to report to Facebook or Twitter or whatever else and give your true identity. Because the truth of the matter is that if you're in a certain environment, the government will put pressure on you know, to get that identity. And before you know it, they'll be persecuted.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't allow social media in certain countries, because they don't allow that anonymity. So I think we need to be slightly careful about that. But the bottom line is, people just feel freer to say and do what they want online and behave in a way that they would not do offline. And the team I ran, we used to investigate people that sent really quite unpleasant or very threatening messages. And sometimes when we went to speak to them, they had no idea they'd even done it. They were that drunk when they did it, they didn't realise.
Wow, okay.
Or they just didn't really, you know, they kind of said, you know what, the minute I sent it, I thought, God, that's a bit tough, you know, but you know, I just sort of sent it and I didn't really sort of think about deleting it. Or some people just thought, and the other argument is, oh, it's freedom of speech. Which again, I think is a bit of a false argument, because those people that have ever been oppressed and abused and threatened, etc., will understand that that's not freedom of speech. And so, you know, does somebody have the right to abuse you racially just because that's what they think they've got the right to do? Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't have laws in this country to say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So there is no absolute right of freedom of speech. There, you know, there's freedom of speech within certain parameters, and we have very liberal parameters in this country, frankly, and the law is such that you have to do something quite significant before you break the law. But the idea that we just all say what we think without any filter is just nonsense. I mean, culturally, that doesn't exist. So why should it exist on the internet?
No, it's not good for society either, for cohesion in society. And
but also, Barry, you know, if you look at how we have set up over, you know, the hundreds of years that we've been here as human beings, we've agreed kind of cultural norms that, you know, that are acceptable and not acceptable ways to behave. You wouldn't go into a, you know, a restaurant and be shouting and swearing and burping and, you know, farting and everything else and expect that to be acceptable.
No.
You know, we know where the cultural norms are in the environment we're in.
Yeah.
We conform to those, whether we like, you know, most people conform to those. And if they don't conform, they generally get asked to leave.
Yeah.
Or they're banned or whatever else. Because the internet's a whole different ballpark.
Yeah.
And so those cultural norms seem to be abandoned online. And again, I don't think there are the same repercussions that exist offline to temper those norms.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people don't know that threats to kill is a crime. You know, I mean, it's just, a really people just don't think. I think that's the problem. And I always think about bringing it back to work. You know, so I work in corporate environments, and because we're all working from home, we are obviously using email a lot. We're using the various video conferencing software. We're using things like Slack for instant messaging.
Yeah.
Have you ever been involved in anything like that in terms of looking internally at how people communicate? And if not, are there some lessons that we could learn internally about how we communicate with people, especially as we're becoming familiar with working from home and, communicating in short bursts and video conferences and, you know, attempting to send emails late, etc., you know?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose from a commercial perspective, you need to agree that what parameters you're going to operate under. I know that, for instance, as you know, if you're working from home, you need to agree with your bosses and your, what hours am I working? What's the expectations of me? Because you might be sat on the computer in the evening doing whatever you're doing, and an email may come in, but are you expected to read it and respond to it? I think first and foremost, you need to set up those parameters at what the expectations are you working from home. Equally, how do you call people out if they are behaving in a way online or communicating in a way online that is not acceptable? Because I think the temptation is to drift into kind of tech speak and online speak and what have you, which is not necessarily a very business way of doing things. Nor is it necessarily acceptable within the business environment. So I think a lot of that needs to be set out in the parameters around, we're now working from home. This is kind of what the rules are, if you like, and this is how we'll behave, and this is what we'll do. Because I think if you don't set those parameters, people will always. It's always like a child, isn't it? They're always kind of push the barriers to see what they can get away with.
Yeah.
So I think, you need to set the parameters and say, right, this is how we're going to behave in the next 5 months or whatever it's going to be, 3 months, 5 months, whatever it's going to be. What images are you going to send?
Yeah.
Because there's also the issue around confidentiality and, sensitivity and all that around business security, around what you're going to communicate online.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. I think we're all learning as we're going on that and hopefully improving,
My wife was working from home before she got, furloughed, what have you. And I said to her, so what are the parameters? What have you agreed? And she said, what do you mean? I said, what hours are you going to work? Because I happen to know you tend to get up really early and you'll log on at sort of 6:30 in the morning. But you wouldn't start work at 6:30 in the morning. So are they getting 2 hours free from you, for instance, or are actually you're going to start at 6:30 but finish at 3:30. So, what are those parameters? If an email, if you get a message at 10 o'clock at night and you read it, are you responsible for it? Or actually, is it okay for you to say, no, I'm not going to respond to that till the morning? How often are you going to check in with your boss? Where's the duty of care around that? So I think there'll be a whole lot of kind of HR stuff that comes out of this working from home environment around, around that, around duty of care and around making sure that you're not working too many hours, you're not working too hard, you're not being held responsible for stuff that sits outside of your ability. Have you got the capability? Have you got, does your internet platform allow you to do certain things? Does your home insurance allow you to work from home?
Yeah, good point.
All those sorts of little things that need to be thought out.
Good point. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, when you start to think it through, because we're kind of just going day to day, you don't necessarily think about all these implications, but it's really interesting. And I think, the audience for this podcast is really people who are interested in digital transformation. But what that means is we're introducing more technology. The last interview I did was with the managing director of an AI machine learning company. So you would think that when you introduce AI and machine learning, it frees up more time for humans to do analysis. How are they going to use that time? Is that time going to be used really well and not kind of straying into areas where the parameters aren't set, so it's interesting. Yeah.
But again, you and I are old enough to remember, before we had mobile phones and before we had computers and everything else, And of course, the whole idea of having all those devices and access to everything was it was going to reduce our workload. It's done the complete opposite.
Yeah.
We're working harder than ever. You know, 30 years ago, when I first joined the police, we didn't have mobile phones, for instance. But no one expected you to work at home at 10 o'clock at night but now, if you've got a mobile phone, a company mobile phone, it's almost like, well, you're contactable 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Well, am I expected to answer that phone at 10 o'clock at night? But equally, I think at the moment we're in extraordinary circumstances, and I think all those things will be just taken into, you know, we're kind of running with it, and I think people will be expected to do that, and that's acceptable. But when we, as we were talking before we went on record, you know, when the world resets and we actually find that we continue some of these practices, well, actually, that's when, you know, those things like insurance about working from home and using your broadband, you know, have you got the right broadband width, and is it secure? And all those sorts of things are going to have to be thrashed out. And what happens? You know, what happens? See, one of the things, going back to what I kind of do, one of the things I'm always fascinated by is if you as an employee download child pornography whilst at work, would your employee expect to be notified? And I think probably they would, because it's you're doing it in work time using potentially work Wi-Fi and everything else.
Yeah.
So if the same argument is made, then if during your working hours you are sending abusive, threatening messages via the internet or via email or via social media, would your work be expected to be told about that?
Interesting. Yeah.
Because I would argue maybe they should be. You know, whilst you're at work in work time, potentially using the internet provided by your work, you are sending those sort of messages.
Mm.
Does your employee own some of the responsibility for that? Do they want to, you know, should they be informed about that? And again, it's all for me about this consequences of doing this. I'm a great, you know, one of my real kind of arguments around social media abuse and online abuse, etc., is there needs to be consequences in order for us to start stopping it. Otherwise, you know, it's the carrot and stick. If there's no stick, then nothing, you know, people just carry on willy-nilly. But what are those consequences? If I'm being told by a client I'm getting all this abuse and threats, etc., from this individual, and we identify that individual, and we identify that actually he was sending it from his workplace at 11 o'clock in the morning, should his workplace be informed? Would your workplace be expected to be informed about this is how your employee is behaving at work during work time using your IP address?
Because, you know, the thing is. If this would come into some advice from you for our listeners, because, you know, what do they do if they are facing an increasing barrage of negativity and abuse online? Where do they go? Because I think a lot of people will think, well, the police aren't going to do anything. But I don't know if that's changed. I mean, what advice would you have for people?
Well, first and foremost, don't respond to it. Mm. What you need to understand is that most of these people are looking for a response.
Yeah.
And they get off on a response. That's what excites them. That's what gives them the pleasure to knowing they've got to you, if you like. So the other thing about it, certainly in the world I work in, you know, one of the reasons we always say don't respond is that many of them will have a far smaller audience or followers or whatever the correct terminology is of the person they're sending the abuse to. So why expose them to all your audience by responding? So we would always say, never respond.
Yeah.
You'll never win the argument. You're never going to make them suddenly think, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. And actually, all you're doing is exposing them and their views, et cetera, to your own audience. Well, why would you want to do that? Secondly, the police will deal with it. You know, if it is a campaign of hostility by an individual, that is harassment or stalking, potentially, depending on the circumstances. If they're sending material that is significantly or really offensive to you, then yes, the police should be informed, because that commits an offence under the Communications Act, and the threat, the level is called grossly offensive. But of course, you need to justify why it's grossly offensive. So something that we grossly offensive to you may not be to me. So it's very subjective. But unless you are able to articulate that, then you know you may not be taken, or they may not investigate it in a way. But if you are grossly offensive, explain why. And the police have got a duty to investigate that thing. and people can commit offences by sending that sort of material by email, by social media, by whatever means. But of course, the police can only deal with it if you tell them. And of course, what you can also do is, if you're, what we used to get a lot of is third-party reporting. So you, Larry, may not see the abuse that you're getting, but somebody else may see it. So that other person can report it. They can report it to the platform that you're being abused on,
yeah,
which will take steps. Just, you know, I know they're not perfect by any major milestone, but I do know they're also linked in with the police quite cleverly. And certainly in my environment, we used to get notified about stuff by Facebook and Twitter and what have you, to say, we've seen this message and we think you should be aware of it. And we had obviously agreed protocols around don't take it down, etc. Because of course, if you take something down off Twitter, if you delete it, it's gone forever. And Twitter will not find it again. So, you know, what we say is don't get people to delete things. You know, capture it, take it. Even if you just take a screenshot of it, you've got it, so that if they do delete it, you're still there. So if something is grossly offensive or very upsetting or abusive or personal, screenshot it. Get a record of it so it's recorded, so that if they delete it, you've still got that evidence that it exists. Because from that, they can identify who it is, potentially.
That's really good advice. I would imagine lots of people maybe ignore it as well, actually, in that sense. But sometimes that's not necessarily a good thing to do, is just ignore those sorts of threats against you.
You shouldn't ignore it, but you shouldn't respond to it. So what you should do is, if you are seeing or receiving anything that you feel is wrong, inappropriate, offensive, abusive, threatening, then you should screenshot it so that you've got a copy of it and you've recorded it, and you should report it. And you should report it either to the social media platform that you're getting or to the police. And or, if you're getting it at work, to your company.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Because obviously, if you're at work, then, and it's coming into your emails, they can filter your emails, so you're not getting it, and they can,
yeah,
you know, the security and HR team that can then manage it on your behalf. But if you're at home and you're getting loads of abuse, if you're being cyberbullied at home, then yeah, record it by screenshotting it. If you don't know how to screenshot it, just take a photograph of your mobile phone.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, capture it in some way so you've got evidence of its existence. Because as I said, if they delete it, a lot of the time it's gone forever and is not retrievable. So capture it, don't respond, report.
Right. Okay, that's really helpful advice. And I think we'll start to round up. But, you know, I think a lot of people, maybe including myself, are hopeful that there'll be some changes to coming down the line, whether it's legal or any other means, to kind of stem the tide of or address online bullying or cyberbullying. Is there anything that can give us hope that things will change, or that there are bodies that would have some teeth that can actually help, that in my opinion don't or won't mess with our liberty?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think we as a community need to be calling it out more often. So my view, you know, my goal is that it becomes as unsociable as smoking, in public or in a bar. Now, years ago, when we were in a pub or in, you know, on, I mean, you know, you and I probably remember the days when you sat in an aircraft and the smoking light went off and they would draw a curtain. Like, that was going to do any good whatsoever. And the whole plane lit up with smoke and what have you. And, you know, now if you did that, that would be, you know, people would be shocked and it would be, you know, frowned upon. So I think we need to get to a place, and we as a society need to stop accepting things and as I say, report everything so that it becomes socially unacceptable to behave that way.
Yeah.
It's socially unacceptable. And I said, it's outside of the cultural norms to behave that way offline. So we need to make it the same online. I think social media companies take a huge responsibility around this, but I would take it one step further. And I would say that we need to be looking at the internet and mobile phone providers, because for me, if you drive your car dangerously, there are repercussions. so you get points in your license and eventually banned from using it. I think if you use the internet or your mobile phone inappropriately, the same should apply. So that if you can't be trusted to use it properly, you don't get to use it at all.
Interesting.
But at the same time, I think the legislation has to move and catch up with where we are, because what we're doing with legislation in the UK particularly is kind of adding bits onto it, and it just frankly isn't fit for what it's there for. And I think there are lots of organisations now that are dealing with cyberbullying and what have you. I think probably there needs to be a far more joined up approach rather than lots of scattering of different approaches. And it probably needs to be part of our syllabus, you know, in terms of how do you behave online?
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good point. And we, you know, it's unfortunate that a lot of, I mean, you know, when we were young, you know, bullying, you could see it and it would happen in school, on the way home from school, whatever, but not in the home. Yeah. And then, like you said before, with access being 24/7, it's just so, so sad and heartbreaking for those parents who lose children because they feel they can't cope because they've been bullied, cyberbullied. It's just, I cannot even believe it. And I think, you know, I'm all about accountability, and I really think that people should be, whoever's been doing that should be called out as children. I don't know how that sits with the law and the police and everything. And obviously we need to treat adults as in the same way, but wow, it's just...
You see, you know, one of the real issues for me, Larry, is I'm going back, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe, you know, about that, maybe a bit longer even. So I was a detective inspector in central London. One of my portfolios was the gang crime aspect of things. And a huge part of that gang crime initiative was a thing called Girls in Gangs. Because what we knew was that the girls were being exploited within the gang culture. And we're talking young girls. And what was happening is young girls were being used to carry drugs, knives, firearms, etc., because they thought they'd left to be searched. But increasingly also, many of the girls would have inappropriate images taken or shared. And then effectively, they would almost be blackmailed into doing certain things for fear of those images being circulated. So that's a very significant way of cyberbullying somebody, but you know, with greater ramifications. So young girls were getting drawn into a criminal lifestyle because they were so terrified about what was going to happen online. And you know, that is still going on. You know, we're still seeing young girls being exploited within the gang environment, within the county lines drug environment now, because of stuff that exists online around, you know, indecent images or so, you know, when we're talking to young girls and boys about what they share online, about, you know, what images or what discussions they share, how they're, you know, when they're sexting or whatever they call it these days, that these have real repercussions if you as a parent don't know what your child's doing. And, you know, the truth is that many parents are far more intrusive into what their kids do offline in terms of who they're associating with, where they're going, what are they doing, but somehow don't feel comfortable being as intrusive online to see who you're communicating with online or on your phone, what are you sharing, who are you sharing it with. And if you're not careful, before you know it, your child is in significant trouble because actually they're being, you know, you might call it bullying, I'd call it extortion. They're being almost blackmailed into doing things, carrying things, you know, getting involved in things they don't want to, because they have shared something that they're now regretting.
Wow, that's insidious, I think is the word.
So, you know, my plea to parents is, in terms of their children, is be as intrusive online as you are offline. You know who your kids are hanging around with offline, hopefully. And you know where they're going and what they're doing. Do you know who they're hanging around with online? You know, do you know what images they're sharing? Do you get to see what they're sharing? You know, I know some parents, for instance, who say, yep, you can use your iPad and your phone, but only downstairs in front of me. You can't use it in the privacy of your bedroom, for instance. Now, that might seem pretty draconian, and it's not for me to dictate to anybody what you do, but I would certainly make the case, you need to know what your child is engaged in online. What are they seeing? What are they doing? What are they sending? What are they receiving? Because if you don't know, then you can't be, you know, you can't be looking out for your child.
Wow. That's definitely sage advice, you know, and definitely makes me think, you know, and I'm sure it'll make our audience think. No, I really appreciate your time, Philip. It's really, really sobering. But then also, you know, encouraging that somebody has got the passion and the means to do something about it and help where possible. What would your kind of parting comment or ask be of our audience?
Well, I think social media is called social media because it's supposed to bring us closer together. And right now, when we're in coronavirus, we're all probably using FaceTime and all sorts of other online mechanisms for good in terms of keeping in touch with our families and our friends and our neighbours and what have you. And, you know, we get a choice how this dictates and how it's used. So I absolutely believe that you know, that social media and the internet and all digital mechanisms, they are not the problem. It's us that are the problem, how we use it.
Mm.
So we have to be responsible. And if you've got children, make sure you know what's going on with your children. And if you're an adult and, you know, and you're seeing or hearing or experiencing things that are wrong, call them out. Record them. You know, don't respond, record them and report them.
Fantastic. No, I appreciate your time. And so where do people find you, Philip, online?
So, you know, you can find me on most of social media on at Philip Grindell or the online bodyguard, as I've now been called by the media in UK. And the company name is Diffuse Global. So if you go to www.diffuseglobal.com, you'll find us there.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.